Hi, thanks to everyone for coming. Thanks to Anne for organizing this along with the other organizers and moderators of this grad student invited symposium. This talk is going to be powered by DayQuil brand cold medicine, which I'm full of right now. It has the unfortunate effect of sort of a methamphetamine-like effect on me. And so, perhaps in stark contrast to Art's lovely and measured talk, I'm going to be trying to restrain myself to some extent. So what I'd like to talk to you today about is some work I've been doing over the past decade or so on a guild of African acacia ants, and more recently trying to use that guild of African acacia ants and the plant with which they interact to understand the dynamics of multi-species mutualisms. So our itinerary today, the first thing I'm going to do is switch up our itinerary. First, I want to talk a little bit about complex mutualisms. And then I'd like to go up to the top and give you an overview of the acacia ant guild, talk a little bit about variation in the quality of those ants as partners to the plant with which they interact, and then move on to long-term dynamics of the ant-plant symbiosis, and finish with some sort of musings about the ecological and evolutionary ramifications of the work that I've just presented. So as you all probably know, mutualisms are ubiquitous, from the deepest sea vents to the highest mountaintops and everywhere in between. They're incredibly important interactions, both from an economic perspective and also the maintenance of biodiversity. The historical perspective of mutualisms is that they are pairs of species that interact and provide a sort of unconditional benefit to one another. That's a definition that characterizes textbooks such as Beagon, Harper, and Townsend, a popular textbook for undergrads and grad students. So I think of this as sort of the happy family version of mutualisms. Everybody's sort of pitching in and being good, and it's good cheer and goodwill. Our current understanding of mutualisms, of course, is that they're considerably more complex interactions. They generally consist of, in fact, almost universally consist of, groups of species that interact with suites of partner species, with variation in the signs of interactions and the strengths of interactions at times. Almost every mutualism, and perhaps every mutualism, some would argue, has been infiltrated by exploiter species. So there are cheaters and parasites that get in there and basically reap benefits from the interaction without actually providing benefits in return. And of course, these mutualisms occur in different environmental contexts. They occur across environmental gradients, things like salinity, light, and productivity. And then to add another layer of complexity, these mutualistic interactions don't occur in a vacuum. They occur embedded within food webs, and the dynamics of those mutualisms may affect the broader food web and vice versa. So I used to think of mutualisms as this sort of happy thing, and now I kind of think of mutualisms as a sort of a much more dysfunctional group of critters that are interacting and sort of hanging together in their own way, but not quite as pretty. So now I'd like to take you on a safari to East Africa, and of course we're going to be talking about ants. This is the point in the talk where usually people start filing out, but here at the entomology conference I'm hoping that maybe people will stay. So my work is conducted at a place called Impala Research Center, which is in the central highlands of Kenya in East Africa, just under the Horn of East Africa there. In a weird kind of ecosystem for the tropics called black cotton savannas. What's weird about it is that the woody plant cover in this system is a monoculture of a single species, Acacia drepanolobium. About 98% of the woody cover is a single plant species. It's a myrmecophyte, so it hosts ants. And it hosts four species of acacia ants. And there's the little arrow. So here's Chromatogaster shastidae, three in the genus Chromatogaster, one in the genus Tetraponera. Chromatogaster shastidae is here, Chromatogaster mimosi, C. nigriceps, and then Tetraponera pemzigai, and I've given them abbreviations which will appear throughout this throughout the presentation. Competition among these acacia ants is really intense. The ants are mutually exclusive on trees, and so they don't co-occur on the same tree unless a violent takeover is in progress. There's nowhere else for these ants to live. The soil's very unstable, so they can't nest in the soil. Very few trees are unoccupied. Violent takeovers are common to sort of come upon if you're walking around in this bushland area. And turnovers, interspecific turnovers in ant occupancy can be as high as 8 to 10% turnover per year. Turns out you can tie these trees together and make ant colonies fight, which is basically what I did my dissertation on. And from that fighting, you can construct a dominance hierarchy, whereas Chromatogaster shastidae is kind of the top dog ant, Chromatogaster mimosi is the next sort of most competitive, and then we have a more subordinate Chromatogaster nigriceps, and then finally Tetrapon or Apensigai, who gets somewhat beat up on. The dominance hierarchy is essentially underlain by colony size. The wars that are fought between different colonies are won by attrition. The bigger colony wins, and Chromatogaster shastidae has the largest colonies on average, around 20 to 22 trees total for their colonies. Chromatogaster mimosi, about 5 colonies on average. Nigriceps has about 3 trees, 5 trees, and Tetrapon or Apensigai is usually a single tree per colony. The sort of maintenance of the diversity of ants in the system is maintained in large part by competition-colonization trade-offs. Our best competitors are good competitors. Our worst competitors are very strong colonists. They produce a lot of queens, and those queens are gaster kickers in contests with other queens for possession of unoccupied saplings. So the queens of these species are very fierce. The mature colonies of these species are very fierce. So that's competition colonization trade-off then creates a sort of what we can then call a set of early successional species. These two subordinate species, Chromatogaster nigriceps and Tetrapon or Apensigai, sort of early successional species, and this is just a figure that shows with increasing tree height how many trees are occupied by those species. And as you can see, they sort of occupy these smaller trees in disproportionate numbers relative to larger trees. And by contrast, the Chromatogaster shastidae and mimosi, these strong competitors, are more late successional species. Their relative abundances increase as tree size gets larger. All right, so the trees provide a service to the ants, right? The trees are providing these things called swollen thorn domatia, in which the ants reside, and also they produce a nectar-producing gland at the base of the rachis of each bicompound leaflet. And here's an ant, Chromatogaster nigriceps, feeding away on that carbohydrate solution that the tree is producing. So the trees are playing fair to some extent. And then the ants in return do what they do, which is to bite. So here's a video of a researcher disturbing a tree, that being me, and there's a lot of ants. So they can provide a pretty effective deterrent to herbivores and also people doing their dissertations. I think I have to click this. Oops, let's just move through here. There we go. Okay, so these four ant species, it turns out, vary really strongly in the benefits they provide to these host plants. Some of them bite a little more intensely than others, in other words. Here are three species, Chromatogaster mimosi, the second most dominant, Nigriceps, a subordinate, and Tetrapon or Apensigai. And these two graphs essentially just show the number of workers recruiting to an artificial disturbance, which is my glove shaking the end of a tree, over 30 seconds. So what you see here is that mimosi, Nigriceps, and Apensigai all are recruiting to some extent to these disturbances. T. pensigai is sort of having lower recruitment to disturbances than the other two ant species. And sort of reflecting that, they have a relatively low level of browse damage by things like giraffe and gazelle and eland and other critters that like to eat these plants, sort of hovering around 2.5% of shoots browsed per year. Each of these ants, however, has a dark side. Chromatogaster nigriceps, although it is a fairly strong protector of host plants, is actually a sterilization parasite. It destroys axillary buds on this tree and prevents the tree from flowering. So that's a pretty dark side if you think about it. You have a partner that treats you pretty well but castrates you. That's not such a great thing. Tetrapon or Apensigai also has a dark side. It's a protector of trees sort of weakly. This graph just shows the growth of small trees on which it's occurring very frequently. This is a period of about 8 years of census data, just averages over that time. And Tetrapon or Apensigai, it's a weak defender, and the host plants that it resides on grow fairly slowly, which is not a good thing for a little plant, because they want to move up through those small size classes quickly to become less vulnerable to things like rodents, and then ultimately to have a large enough colony to kind of protect them from the big nasties. Okay, the darkest of our interactors is Chromatogaster shastidae, that top dominant species. This is the same figure I showed you for protection and browse damage before with the three other species. As you can see, they're real lazy. They don't protect host plants at all. They don't swarm onto your glove. If they do get on your glove, they don't bite you. And browse damage levels are quite high on trees occupied by Chromatogaster shastidae. To make matters worse, their trees really look awful. Here's an example of a Chromatogaster shastidae occupied tree. They're full of holes. Those holes are often leaking sap. They're covered in lichens, so they just don't look good. The reason they don't look good, it turns out, is Chromatogaster shastidii actually actively facilitates a cerambycid beetle that burrows holes throughout the main stem. It's a sort of cancerous appearance of the inside of this tree that's about 2 meters tall. And in those tunnels, Chromatogaster shastidii lives. So they're basically employing this little cerambycid to create nest space for themselves. Okay, so those effects of Chromatogaster shastidii, sort of low protection and the facilitation of cerambycid beetles, it seems like it's pretty rough on the host plants. These are just annual growth data over an 8-year period for about 1,800 trees. And all I want you to notice is that the black bar is Chromatogaster shastidii across tree height classes, so from tiny little trees up to really big trees. These are trees in meters. They have relatively slow growing trees, suggesting that, you know, that cerambycid damage and non-protection is not super healthy for plants. Similarly, if you look at cumulative mortality of all those trees over an 8-year period, Chromatogaster shastidii again has a relatively high proportion of those trees that of their host plants that die relative to the three other species. All right, so here's the whole dysfunctional crew. C. shastidii, the ungrateful parasite. Mimosi, the caring, decent mutualist, right? Strong protector. It's kind of the Girl Scout. It doesn't do anything particularly bad, and it's good for the trees in the short term. Here's Nigriceps, is a decent mutualist that castrates host plants, and then T. pensigae is a somewhat mediocre mutualist. All right, so what keeps this mutualism stable? Traditional sort of theoretical approaches to trying to understand mutualism stability in the face of cheating focus a lot on punishment, on partner sanctions, and mechanisms of partner choice. And I don't want to talk about those things today. What I'd like to talk about is lifespan inequalities. It turns out that Acacia japanilobium lives up to about 200 years. And so during the course of their lifetime, ants will come onto trees and then leave trees, right? And so here's species one, and then the tree maybe is empty for a while, then species three comes on, then two, then four, then maybe two again, and empty again. So there's a lot of sort of dynamism over the course of a plant's lifetime. And I wanted to talk a bit about how that might influence these ant plants. And you know, you can generalize this situation to any mutualist, any long-lived mutualist that interacts with a short-lived partner. So corals with their zooxanthellae, long-lived plants with their pollinators or seed dispersers, or mycorrhizal associates or rhizobial associates. So this question of lifespan inequality leads to a lot of questions. So the first question is, are these short-term benefits, these unidimensional parameters that we're looking at, like protection, the most important thing to a long-lived mutualist? Is that what they care about? And how might these longer-lived partners cope with the variation in partners that they see over a lifetime? So what we've done is we marked in 1997 1,800 trees, and every year we've been censusing them for growth, for ant occupant, and for survival and reproduction. And what that's allowed us to do is kind of mine those data over a period longer than a grant cycle to look at some other questions about ant performance. So one of the really striking things that's come out of that is that ant species differ really strongly in their fidelity to host plants. So this is the proportion of trees here that have been abandoned by ants. And look at that, the sort of good Girl Scout mutualist actually has relatively low fidelity. So it's kind of a fickle ant. It'll abandon trees pretty quickly. They have those larger colonies, and during dry seasons they often retract off of some satellite trees, leaving that tree empty. The fate of those empty trees is not a pretty sight. These are the proportion of trees that are surviving when they're occupied by four ant species and empty. And as you can see, survivorship of empty trees is quite a bit lower than those that are occupied by ants. So having an ant is a lot better than not having an ant, irrespective of who that ant is. Similarly, fruiting in these large trees above 3 meters in size comes out, it's higher for the parasite, Chromatogaster shastidii, and for this weak protector, T. pensigae. This I could sort of speculate on what's going on here, and I'd be happy to talk about that later, but no time right now. And the cold medicine is really kicking in. Okay, so how do we put the long-term dynamics of a multi-species mutualism together in a sensible way? The first step I had to do was decide to trust this man, not the Unabomber, but Dan Doak, a friend and collaborator of mine who has worked on some models with me. And essentially what we've tried to do is tie the effects of these mutualists to tree fitness in the long term. So we're trying to talk about tree fitness for a plant that lives, you know, a couple hundred years. And what we did was we used AIC to fit the best sort of statistical models to predict how the ant in resident at the present time and a tree life stage, you know, how big the tree is, essentially, influence future tree growth, survivorship, reproduction, and occupants. So we fit a series of about 5 to 15 models for each of these parameters, and we used AIC to pick the best one. And then what we did was constructed demographic models using those probabilistic statements from the AIC stuff to figure out, you know, for a given ant species, what's the fate of a tree that's tiny? Does it grow? Does it reproduce? Does it lose height, which can happen for big trees when they get knocked over by elephants? And then, of course, we did this for all ant species, so there's transitions among all these different ant species for all these different height classes, and there are a lot of height classes. So it turned out we have 175 by 175 cell matrix, and this is the kind of thing Dan revels in, and I fear. So then what we did is we validated the model. So we got this big demographic model parameterized from real-world data. We take a nearby community of acacia ants, very close, you know, maybe a mile or so away. We took the sort of stable state distribution or the ant by height occupation of about 4,000 trees. We plugged it into our demographic model, and it turns out that the model world, the sort of ant by size distribution, and these are just the four different ant species here, and empty trees, pretty closely mirrors what we find in the real world in the original 1800 tree data set. So we basically used a sort of tested the validity of this model in as non-circular a way as we could. We then conducted stochastic simulations to ask how many ant species occupy a tree over its lifetime. Turns out it's a lot. By 80 years, a tree is about 3 meters tall, has all the ant species on it. At 80 years, it's had all the ant species on it at one point, and about 15 transitions. So that's a lot of transitions. The next question we can ask, and now we really got to speed up, do trees occupied by these different ants show different trade-offs in survival versus reproduction? And it turns out they do. Here's the castration parasite, promotes pretty high survival, pretty low fruiting. The weakling Mutualis tetraponera, very high survival and actually high fruiting when they're on trees that are tall. Our best mutualists here, sort of intermediate survival and intermediate levels of fruiting, and our parasite mutualist, low levels of survivorship but high levels of fruiting. And so the final step, and I'm almost done, is which we could ask then which ants are good for tree fitness. We rebuilt this model, which removing different ants, which Dan says is somewhat tricky, in order to measure tree fitness. And that's lambda to the 50. So if Dan Doak says it's somewhat tricky, that's like Alan Hastings saying this problem is not trivial, which means you walk away at that point. And it's a theoretician saying this is tricky. But anyway, we've used a lot of different possible models, and the qualitative results are always the same. And here's what it looks like. So we've modeled pretend communities of a single ant species on a tree throughout its life, two ant species on a tree throughout its life, three ant species, and then the total community. This is the green is Tetraponera pensiga, the weakling, this is the castrator, the good mutualist, and the parasite. And the first thing you'll notice is that the higher the number of ants you have on trees over a lifetime, the higher the population growth rate of the tree. So that's kind of funky, because having the best mutualist here, seeing Mimosi, this good Girl Scout, not so great for lifetime fitness. When you add a castrator, when you add a weak mutualist, and when you add a parasite, you actually increase overall fitness of the host plants. And that's because these trees are essentially trading off survivorship at early life stages. That's what they want. They want to survive, not reproduce necessarily. And when they get older, they want to reproduce, and survival becomes less of an issue. So when we sort of think about protection in this unidimensional way, we're kind of missing the boat. The weak mutualist and the parasite are sort of the best partners in this mutualism, as it turns out. Here is Tetraponera pensiga. This is the weak mutualist and the parasite. Here's the weak mutualist, the parasite, and the castrator, and that they have higher fitness overall than some of the other communities. And the best mutualist doesn't look so hot anymore. I don't have time for musings, unfortunately, but the main take-home message is the value of these ant partners to the tree depends on the complex interaction between the life history stage of these plants, the protective benefit of the ant, the fidelity of the ant, which is really key, and the effect of the ant on plant reproduction. And I'd like to thank Dan Doak, Mimosi, and John Lomboy, Simon Arquam, and the NSF for funding my stuff. Thanks.
You were going back on talking about your model and the simulations. Can you
Yeah, so we basically used multinomial and logistic regression to sort of ask whether sort of how ant and height class affected survivorship and reproduction and ant state and stuff like that. So we take ant and we take height to the 0.05 and height squared and all that stuff and use AIC to use those to basically make those predictions. And then we plug this all into a sort of first order Markov demographic model using those particular probabilities that were generated by the statistical models to then, you know, it's basically a massive matrix model where we take the sort of current stable state distribution of tree height by ant occupant in those 175 states, we multiply it by a matrix of those probabilities to create a right eigenvector, which gives us a stable state distribution, also lambdas for host plant growth. I've got lots of details that I can talk to you about after this, if you'd like. Yeah, thank you. The elephants are rough on trees, and that's the next End Society meetings. I have some really fun stuff to talk about elephants. So, thanks again.